Hello, and welcome to the Library Cafe, a program about research, libraries, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm very delighted to have on the show today several of the curators who assemble the exhibition on view in the Thompson Memorial Library here at Vassar College, which will be up until June 15th. The exhibition is entitled Beauty Out of the Ashes: Printed Works of the Harlem Renaissance, 1923 to 1936. I'm Thomas Hill. With me are Ron Patkus, Head of Special Collections and Adjunct Professor of History on the Frederick Weyerhaeuser Chair. Hello, Ron.
Hi, Tom.
Good to see you. Next, we have Eve Dunbar, Professor of English on the Jean Webster Chair. Hello, Eve.
Hi, Tom.
And the third guest today is Carolyn Culp, Adjunct Assistant Professor of Art History. Hello, Carolyn.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having us.
I should mention that this exhibition has a visual online component that you can link to if you go to the Library Cafe website at librarycafe.org. So, this is an exhibition of key publications of the Harlem Renaissance. And I wonder if you all can talk about how the exhibit came about. I know these are often collaborations of people teaching courses and rare books, and it seems to be the case here.
I'll let you start it, Ron, since you
Okay.
actually began.
Yeah, you're right, Tom. It grows out of some of the classes that Eve has been teaching in the Special Collections Library. We've been collaborating with her on classes for a number of years. But the proximate reason was that this year, 2023, was the 100th anniversary of the publication of Jean Toomer's novel, Cain. And with that in mind, I began contemplating, the possibility of doing something around that. So Eve and I had some conversations, talked about different possibilities. There were different routes we could have taken. But in the end, we thought the best thing would be to connect with a class that she taught last fall. And so that the exhibition is on view now in the spring of 23 to connect with the anniversary of that publication.
And the exhibition is to some extent then a product of the class. Is that the case? Not just something for the class to see, but that was actually created by the students in the class.
Yeah, it's actually going to work with two of my classes. One was a seminar that I taught with juniors and seniors in the fall, and they're the students who created the labels for the books on exhibit. And this semester, I teach a course called The Harlem Renaissance and Its Precursors, which focuses on pretty much early African American literature up to African American literature of the 1920s and 30s, the Harlem Renaissance. And those students will participate as viewers of the exhibit and hopefully get a chance to work more intimately with those materials.
Will they be sort of reviewing the show? The way libraries seem to work, we offer to the world and our patrons the opportunity to revise what we present before them. And then they create, ideally, new content for the libraries. But it's wonderful you've got two groups of students, then one group of readers and one group, to some extent, of creators. Yes. Although your creators are also researchers, aren't they? I mean, didn't they research materials for the exhibit?
Yeah, it was actually a really great learning experience and opportunity for them to curate, co-curate. Ron allowed us to be co-curators with him, and they did their primary research on the particular books that they were assigned and the publication histories and a bit of commentary on those covers and those texts. We went down to the library special collections with Ron, and each student got to handle and work with that primary text and take notes. And perhaps, Ron, you can tell us a little bit about when we came down, what you were hoping from us.
Yeah, it's funny, whenever we do an exhibition, we have to think about its conception and its logistics. And often it's me and faculty working together, but I love the possibilities when students can become involved. It's classic Vassar undergraduate learning, going to the source, learning from things firsthand that may not have been experienced before. And I think Eve would agree with me that one thing I find is that the students bring a lot to this kind of a project too. And it took on its own life and meaning through their work. And a lot of the comments that we've received about the exhibition, I think, reflect on the contributions of students, not just our involvement as faculty.
That's wonderful. So the three of you actually contributed essays to the catalog, beautiful catalog, and great essays, really interesting essays, all three. But also very interesting are the labels that the students created. And these aren't little exhibition labels like you'd find in the Loeb Center with maybe a paragraph or two on them. They're really pieces of text that really draw you in, and they add a lot of textual material to the exhibit. And it's really good reading. Most of them are really kind of mesmerizing and informative.
We shared with them at the beginning some examples of previous exhibition labels. Mm-hmm. So they had that as a working model. But again, I just have to say, it's so enlightening, really, to see how they take that and shape it. There are things that I might have done differently, but there are also things I learned from. And I think that's what you want in a learning community, to have that exchange. Yeah. Would you agree with that, Eve?
Yeah, and I would say a couple of things in addition. Caroline shared with me some tips on putting together labels from her kind of museum experience and art experience. And I shared that with the students. And I don't know, Caroline, if you want to talk a bit about that. But we also took a tour during a class period of an exhibit that was up prior to this one. And we did the thing of visiting it, but then we sort of sat outside the library and did a critique.
That's great.
And what did they like about what they saw in the other exhibit, but what they would change. And we, as a group, decided on a kind of content and aesthetic principle that each of the students bought into because they developed it. And so, to a certain extent, there should be a kind of uniformity across those labels because they agreed on certain things that they, a tone that they wanted to strike.
I love that. What a great idea. What a great plan as a teacher and an instructor too, to have students walk through another exhibition that's an example of theirs and think really critically about the way that it's exhibited, the way the text engages the viewer. Those are all really critical parts of this. I love that idea. Maybe I'll use that in the future. Sharing with Eve some materials about how to write engaging labels, because you have to, it's a different sort of writing for students. You know, it's an exciting challenge for them. I think they're so used to writing papers of four or five or six pages. But in an exhibition label, you have to capture the attention of busy and moving audience in the space of 100 words. I mean, it's really difficult, maybe even 80 words. Yeah. So the students did such a fantastic, wonderful job. And I hope that it was a good learning experience for them.
You also have to do justice to the work you're writing about, right? Because the work is right there, sort of staring right at what you've done. More so, perhaps, with a painting on the wall, but even that's the case with a book. If you have the physical object there, you've got more of an incentive to do justice to what it is that you're presenting to the world.
Just one last bit, Tom. You know, one thing this project was about was not just reading the texts that I think they were reading texts, but also to think about how these books and writings were received immediately by their audiences, you know, 100 years ago, and taking a close look at what that would have been like and asking some questions that are complementary, I think, to a discussion of the texts. That was a big part of the project.
One thing I always notice about these rare book exhibits is that the object quality of the work, it can be as important as the text itself and have a lot to tell you about how it was received and what it means, because how it was received has a lot to do with the meaning of the text, I think. So this collection, Ron, does it come entirely out of our holdings in the Vassar Libraries?
That's a great question. Yes. But one thing I would say, and one thing I note in my preface in the catalog is, you know, when I came to Vassar, there was some paperwork that said we had a collection of African-American writers. And they had been trying to build it up upon my arrival, you know, what, 23 years ago. But there were definitely some lacunae, some silences, as often said today, in the collection. Vassar simply hadn't collected a lot of this material when it originally came out, but in large part to connect with the teaching that Eve and others do, I continued that work, and we've tried to build up some of those holdings. And in fact, we're still talking about other writers from the time that we can add. So there were some materials there, but we have added to it, and I'd say it's still an ongoing project.
So what do we have in the collection apart from the Harlem Renaissance materials in terms of African American holdings?
Eve, in the course that she's teaching now, we do one class on precursors to the Harlem Renaissance. And we have some major examples there. For instance, Phyllis Wheatley, we have a first edition of her poems with her signature on it. And it was given to us by Alma Lutz, the famous Vassar grad and Vassar professor who focused on the history of women in American life. We have a first edition of Frederick Douglass going further into the 19th century. And then in the late 19th century, we have some other authors like Paul Laurence Dunbar and others. So we actually have a class on some of the precursors before we even do the class on the Harlem Renaissance examples. Again, these are representative examples. I'm glad we have them and they're good for teaching, but there's still room for growth there.
So was any of the material that you pulled into the show from the general collection in the main library, or was it all a special collection?
Yes, I think there were a couple of items.
Yeah.
I can't remember off the top of my head, Tom. I'd have to check, but I think there were a couple.
Well, I noticed this whenever you have an exhibition, we find materials in the general collection that are very rare that are actually in the collection. We just haven't pulled them into a special collection. So
that's fun.
Yeah,
and
it is.
Another thing that I remember, Ron, is you sort of used the occasion of this exhibition to acquire a few covers.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe they were facsimiles, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So sort of rounding out a few historic book collections. Could you speak about that?
Yeah, that connects directly with what Tom was just saying, that sometimes we didn't have anything in special collections, but there was a copy in the main library. But of course, since it was in the main library, they hadn't preserved the dust jacket. But the dust jacket, especially for a project like this, is crucial to understanding how that book circulated, and especially with the work that Caroline does, you know, focusing on art and artists. So in a couple of occasions, we've looked at whether we should acquire another copy of the book, complete with the Dutch jacket. We've done that on a couple of occasions. And on a couple of occasions, as Caroline just said, we've also just acquired a facsimile dust jacket simply for teaching purposes.
Yeah.
But those are important. And together, I think there's a fuller view of what was presented.
Yeah, Ron, you mentioned in the conversation we had about a week or two ago that some of this material is much more expensive now than it used to be. I mean, if you go to acquire something with a pristine dust jacket, you have to be ready to spend money. So.
Totally. Four and sometimes five figures.
So anyway, one of these jackets ended up on the cover of the, the illustration from it ended up on the cover of the catalog. And it really is a wonderful catalog with a really stunning cover on it. And it seems to be doing very well. I notice you can't keep them as giveaways in front of the exhibit for very long without putting another pile up. So
we're doing a second printing, a complete second printing.
Oh, great. And the essays, as I say, are wonderful inside. It's a wonderful little publication. Beautifully designed. And I don't know who our designer is. We used to have, I think, one of the best in the business with George Laws.
Yeah.
But now that he's retired, I suppose it seems you've found another designer.
Yeah, Aidan Gallagher is now there. The graphic designer that we worked most closely with in the communications office at Vassar.
So the title, Beauty Out of the Ashes, how did that come about? Is that from one of the texts?
Tom, I can answer that, but does anyone else want to give it a stab before I do?
It's from Alain Locke, right?
Uh-huh.
A Locke essay that Ron ran across and sent an email to Caroline and me. Was it midsummer saying... Because I think we were emailing back and forth about titles.
I actually have it in my files. April 5th, 2022, Ron says, I was recently reading essays of Alain Locke and came across one titled Beauty Instead of Ashes.
Uh-huh.
The final line mentions that beauty out of the ashes. That struck me as a candidate for our exhibition title. Though if we use it, maybe the subtitle should be adjusted. What do you think about something like Beauty Out of the Ashes, African American Art and Letters, 1920 to 1936. So as you can see, this is our original primary title, but not the secondary title. So as with any project, goes through multiple iterations, because our final title, of course, is Beauty Out of the Ashes, Printed Works of the Harlem Renaissance, 1923 to 1936.
Titles are really important. They're like poetry. Everything that's in the exhibit is distilled in those couple of words. And it really kind of rings nicely. So it's part of what makes the book, I think, the title you got.
Yeah, I honestly think the combination of the title and the cover design has pulled people and maybe drawn them to it in some way. Yeah.
Big question, what was the Harlem Renaissance? I mean, you started with Jean Toomer's novel, but often these literary periods, I mean, you talk about the Romantics, the classical period, the Victorian period, there's no hard, fast definition. So is this less the case with the Harlem Renaissance? And how is it defined? I mean, we all know what it is in a sense, because there's so many figures in the Harlem Renaissance that come forward. But you've got specific dates here, don't you? 1923 to 1936, probably thinking about specific texts. Jean Toomer with the 1920s. And then 36, is that?
It's Arna Bontemps' Black Thunder.
I see. Oh, that's right. So does anybody want to take on the question, what is the Harlem Renaissance? Or is it too big a question to really
Well,
ask?
that's what Eve's opening essay deals with.
I won't take it on because it is a huge, and it's, I think with all periodization, it's subject to interpretation and perspective. But we start in 23 because that's the year that Cain is published. Mm-hmm. And prior to Cain's publication, Toomer's Cain, there hadn't been an African-American novel published by a major publishing house. Mm-hmm. So it's significant for that reason. I think the beginning, lots of scholars will begin it in 1919 with the end of the First World War. Yeah. And then 36 is arbitrary in some ways because that's perhaps the last Harlem Renaissance text that Special Collections had an early edition of. You know, it could be material dictating our end date. Mm-hmm. But mid-30s, people, scholars usually say the Harlem Renaissance fades due to the stock market crash, due to a shift in political focus of African-American writers because of a variety of things. I'm wondering if the art world is a different narrative in terms of beginnings and ends.
Yeah, I certainly think so. And just to put it out there for any listeners who need a little bit of a refresher, the Harlem Renaissance wasn't just literature. It was this huge blossoming of Black culture in the arts, the visual arts, theater, fashion, politics, music, of course, jazz, dance, scholarship, philosophy, all of these different modes of thinking and producing new thoughts. So I'm just thinking of the arts in the 1930s, we do get a kind of, I don't know, political constriction a little bit, but there's a moving on from that specific period of high Renaissance, you would say.
Yeah, interesting. There does seem to be a sort of explosion here. The thing about the Harlem Renaissance is it seems to be a kind of explosion of American everything, in a sense. You know, there's almost no distinction in my mind between jazz, say, and American music, what we have to contribute to the world. And you can say the same thing about the arts with Romare Bearden and Jacob Lawrence. There's really something different going on there. And of course, with the literature also. So anyway, it seems to be a real phenomenon, justifiably of interest as a period. So you've got this explosion of culture. And I wonder if, Carolyn, you could talk about the visual side of the Harlem Renaissance, and which is larger than, although it might be emblemized in our covers here in the exhibit. But they do emblemize it in some way. So, and they emblemize modernism in an interesting way, too, to underscore my point here.
Yeah, certainly. So one of the reasons why I was so glad to be included on this project is because of the absolute critical position of book illustrations in the beginning of the visual and artistic Harlem Renaissance. So in my essay, I write about Aaron Douglas, who's one of the most important figures in the art side of the Harlem Renaissance. And what I think is so great about his story, and you get this in the opening lines of my essay, but he was teaching art in a high school in Kansas City and encouraged by figures who were sort of high up in what was then called the New Negro Movement to come to New York City and take part in this revolution in Black life that was happening in Harlem. So Aaron Douglas did, he moved and he slept on a friend's couch while he was taking painting lessons. But the way that he really got his start was in developing black and white illustration for books, book covers, and also illustrations on interior pages. He also did like some kind of smaller designs that would go at the tops and the bottoms of pages. Ron, I don't know if there's a special name for that, but you know, sort of graphic, flat pictorial design or pseudo pictorial designs. It's just such a great story because Aaron Douglas, this monumental figure in the history of the Harlem Renaissance, who is best known for creating mural scale, very colorful, bright, graphic pictures that illustrate the history of Black life in the United States, in the Americas. He got his start working at this small scale in book illustration. And I think that's just so captivating. And his illustrations, his artistic practice really pulls from a bunch of different sort of like aesthetic practices of the day and melds them together into something that's really new and fresh. So he's pulling from the aesthetics of Art Deco patterns, transatlantic modernism, and he's using these aesthetic principles and designs to remake symbols and iconography from the Egyptian tradition, from biblical tradition. So wrapping this all together in very graphic and sort of modernist, colorful principles, he's creating what I really think is a new aesthetics, a new symbology of modern Black life, this surging forth of beautiful and productive culture that's coming out of Harlem at this moment. It's a really unique and kind of concentrated explosion of art making at this time.
Really fascinating. And it comes through in the exhibition. You can see these book designs. Interesting that a book designer should also be a muralist, because I can think of another example in Violet Oakley, who has the big triptych in the alumni house here. She starts out as a book illustrator. Of course, she had to. That was the only way she could make a living when she was younger. But she studied under famous illustrators. And then she became a muralist because of that. You know, she worked with stained glass for a while because the form seemed to be able to transfer over to that art form. And then she went into murals. So
I think that's really a great observation, Tom. And it makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. Because as an illustrator, and as a muralist, you're trying to create these images that are highly legible, they're supremely graphic, and immediately recognizable by an audience.
You're not just working for other artists, you're working for the public in general in both cases, for illustrators and muralists, right? So
And this also intersects, I'll say, as one who is currently teaching a course called The Book in America, this intersects with a development in the history of the book in this country, where we're getting away from what are called publisher's bindings and the emergence of the Dutch jacket in the early 20th century. And so my point is, there are simply opportunities there for artists to contribute to that form of art, which had been a little different before that.
Yeah, just one last thing on this from your point, Ron, is I'm just so fascinated and captivated by the fact that I really think yet another way that the Harlem Renaissance is unique in terms of an American arts movement is that it does grow and develop out of the book, out of the publishing industry, and the forms, the aesthetic qualities, the kind of political and sociological impetus of this whole movement in the arts is coming from its origin point in literature. And that is a fascinating confluence.
There's been some writing on this in scholarly literature, but I think there's room for more. your essay, I think, is a contribution.
Yeah, another part of this, of course, is music. We're not really talking about music, but, you know, I'm thinking of, well, if we do have any time at the end of the show, I'll play music. And the possibilities are endless, from Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong, you know, major figures, but also, you know, Bessie Smith, even Cab Calloway. I mean, there's so much here that I could play. And again, with jazz, it's incredibly popular right from the get-go, and it translates and migrates into what becomes American music per se, and partly because it is so accessible, you know, and it's powerful.
Yeah, well, and included in the show are a number of illustrations by Aaron Douglas and a few others, I think, but of jazz musicians jazz instrumentation, I guess. So, for example, God's Trombones, which is illustrated by Aaron Douglas, God's Trombones by James Weldon Johnson, 1927. The cover has the angel Gabriel, who is shown striding between these two worlds and blowing in this poignant silhouette on a trumpet. So it's sort of like the end of days. And then another key book cover, again, by Aaron Douglas, is Claude McKay's Home to Harlem. It was published in 1929 and shows this Black figure with hands upraised in between the skyscrapers of New York City. And you have this looping, scrawled form of musical notes that are coming out of the silhouette of a piano keys. So incorporating jazz and music as this key symbol of the overall movement and of the time.
I would only add, in addition to jazz, and I think we think of jazz as kind of America's music, right? Is the blues. The blues is so important.
Are they ever?
Of course, of course.
And I think of, you know, on display is Langston Hughes, who has a number of blues poems. The Weary Blues is one of the texts that we have on display. And I would kind of just highlight this. What makes the Harlem Renaissance so important is that it also marks the beginning of the Great Migration, which is the movement of African Americans from the rural South to more urban northern contexts. And with them, they bring all the aspects of their culture, music being key. And so the blues tradition is kind of being put on record and being disseminated at this key moment. And so the blues permeates the aesthetics of so many Black writers. I just want to kind of, for the record, think about the origin of so many people, but also the culture that African Americans are bringing with them as they move into these northern contexts, and the stories in the sound is part of that tradition.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And then blues becomes urbanized and modernized and also globalized too, because in addition to all of these Blacks who are migrating north from the South, you also get the influx of a lot of international immigrants, Black immigrants as well.
Into Harlem, yes, right. Yes,
into Harlem. It's just this beautiful moment of melting and recreation and coming together.
The exhibit starts chronologically in 1923, as we mentioned, with Jean Toomer's Cain. And I wonder, how does Cain mark an historical change here that might be a marker for the beginning of the movement? It seems to do this both in terms of its content and its form. Can someone talk about Toomer's Cain a bit?
So yeah, Toomer produces Cain after spending a period of time in Georgia working as an interim principal for an agriculture school. And he's so moved by having arrived in this rural town that he's compelled to write about it. We call it a novel, but it's mixed form. It's poetry, it's fiction, it's drama. There's some visual art elements to the text. And it's this mixed form, the abstractness, the repetition of imagery that moves through the text that so many writers, Black and white, find compelling. So it's a text that bridges the Harlem Renaissance and high modernism. And as writers of the period begin to coalesce in New York in particular, tumor is someone they're reading who they are looking to as an influence or inspiration. He ultimately, interestingly enough, kind of disaffects from the African-American community. He doesn't identify as Black. He doesn't necessarily identify as white. He identifies as American. And so even though someone like Alain Locke claims tumor as an African-American writer, in his anthology, The New Negro, Toomer would not himself have identified in that way. So even including or beginning the Harlem Renaissance exhibition with Toomer is not without its own problems, right? Mm-hmm. Because would he want to be part of the Harlem Renaissance?
Well, it seems so contemporary, though, doesn't he? Just sort of a transrational, non-essentialist, you know, idea of what it means to be a human being. So
a kind of non-binary,
yeah, exactly,
understanding that, you know, the U.S. at this point is not ready for. We're still kind of living within the color line where there's a one drop rule. And so if you have one drop of Black blood, you're Black. Toomer didn't feel that way.
Yeah, very wisely, I think. So how does Toomer then work into this transition from the old Negro to the new Negro? The question is, what is the difference here then between the old Negro and the new Negro?
I mean, it really depends on who's doing the talking. So if it's Alain Locke, he would say, in theory, the old Negro is a fiction. It is part of the American white imaginary. And one of the things that Locke says is that the old Negro is a construct that is not developed by Black people. And so the new Negro is the articulation of Blackness by Black people. That said, it gets read as the old Negro is Southern, is rural, is very close to the enslaved subject. And the new Negro is modern, is urban, is much more assimilatable and assimilated. And so you have someone like Zora Neale Hurston, whose works are on display in the exhibition, who would say, well, hold on. I'm with you in terms of modernity, but what is the nature of modernity? Does rurality discount someone in terms of their relationship to modernity? No. So she would write figures who spoke in dialect, who lived in the South, in rural America, Caribbean people, people who practiced root medicine and hoodoo. And these were modern subjects just as much as, you know, the figure walking down the street of Harlem, the Black figure in a zoot suit and a fur driving a car. So I think there's some debate at every level. The easiest way to think about the old Negro is that that character is a character of the white imaginary.
There is an anthropological wisdom in Hurston there, isn't there? I mean, she's a student of Boas and contemporary and fellow student, you know, with Margaret Mead and
Ruth Benedict.
Yeah,
Vassar grad.
Yeah. So we have a Langston Hughes in the exhibit. I'm thinking of Langston Hughes' great poem in this regard, "Let America Be America Again," which Eve quotes in her essay, which, especially in contrast to Claude McKay's poem, which you also quote, Eve, expresses a kind of desire to shift the focus of Black experience from object to subject, from victim to agent, you could almost say, from imaginary to something that's real, though. So I wonder if that's what Hughes represents here, in a sense, to people, why he's so optimistic, seems to be optimistic. And I don't know if we should maybe take a moment out to read that little excerpt from this "Let America Be America Again," because it's really an inspiring thing. In a way, for me, it sums up your whole exhibit here and the intellectual side.
It begins, "Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe."
Yes.
Wonderful work. And as I say, very optimistic and healing in a way. McKay's poem was rather angry and rightfully so, but basically the import is that we're not going to just allow ourselves to be slaughtered here like pigs.
I can read that, Tom. So it's from McKay's sonnet, "If We Must Die," and it begins, "If we must die, let it not be like hogs hunted and penned in an inglorious spot while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs, make their mock of our accursed lot. If we must die, oh, let us nobly die so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain.
So it's a kind of heroic statement and a desire to fight back in a sense. Hughes is something a little different there. Basically, he's saying that as far as the nation goes, the real Americans here are we African Americans. So that freedom, you know, the thing that the country was founded on, is something that African Americans know about and live every day, that desire. That's what the poem means to me when I read it anyway. And so, you know, the Black experience is quintessentially an American experience, a revolutionary experience in a sense, and it's ongoing too. You know, it didn't all end when the founding fathers united the 13 colonies, because the nation was founded on these principles of equality, but we haven't been living those principles. And the desire to have liberty is still, you know, very much a part of the African-American experience. I don't know if that makes any sense, if I'm just talking off the top of my head, but Hughes comes through big time like that. And that's what I'm saying, the whole Harlem Renaissance, for me, it's like the refounding of American culture in a sense.
I think that's a really profound way to think about it. And in terms of a more inclusive, so Hughes ends that poem by saying, "Oh yes, say it plain. America never was America to me. And yet I swear this oath, America will be." And to me, those lines are so kind of, they're a threat and a promise and a kind of restoration in the hope, if one believes in American democracy, that it would be inclusive for all people, for workers, for Black people, for women, for whomever feels like that category of American has not been granted fully to them. And I think Hughes is a people's poet, and he understands what the people want and need, and is promising us that we'll get it if we fight for it, right? And it's very different from McKay.
Although I like McKay also, but they're not incompatible, actually, in a sense. But so we talked about Zora Neale Hurston, but there's also Nella Larsen and Jess Redman Fawcett in the show. And I wonder, can you talk about them a bit? Because it's interesting, oftentimes you'll get a show about revolutionary artists or revolutionary movement, and then you realize the revolutionaries are pushing the women revolutionaries off, you know, off to the side. That happened with socialism sort of generally. So
yeah, that's actually really interesting, because I can't think of the Harlem Renaissance without thinking of women writers, for me as a lit scholar. And these women in particular are, Fawcett is an editor. So she's editing, I think it's Du Bois's, the NAACP magazine periodical, The Crisis.
The Crisis.
Section, the literary section of The Crisis. And so she is integral in setting the literary taste of the readers of The Crisis, who would have been a kind of multiracial readership, right? It's not just Black people who are reading The Crisis. There's a lot of white readers, going back to the issue of patronage. And so they're embedded in the literary movement as we know it. And a writer like Hurston, who's trained in anthropology, doing folklore collecting, writing fiction, kind of working in all the realms. And Nella Larsen, who writes some of the most interesting fiction focused on questions of race and gender in class during the period. So all of these women's issues are part and parcel of how we understand the Harlem Renaissance. I don't know what it looks like in the art world, in the visual arts, however.
Yeah. And the blues world, you've got, you know, Jesse Smith and Ma Rainey, and there are, you know, a few important figures.
Number of Black women's blues artists. Yeah, that's true. And they're pushing the bounds on Black women's sexuality and questions of autonomy and bodily autonomy and authority.
Yeah, big time. So
in the visual arts, you have Augusta Savage.
Yeah, she's a sculptor. Yes.
Sculptor. And Elizabeth Catlett, who was a printmaker.
Yeah.
But those are a little bit more fringe. I wouldn't say that they're central figures.
It was a bit, just a big show on Elizabeth Savage, I think, in the city, wasn't there, a while back, maybe a year or two ago. So
yeah, and there are definitely stirrings and plans for a show on Elizabeth Catlett.
Oh, there are. Okay, great. Some of the books in the exhibit seem to me a bit edgy in a way, even for the movement itself. And I'm thinking of Wallace Thurman's Infants of the Spring. and also of Rudolf Fischer and George Schuyler's titles. And I wonder how those fit in, and do they tell us anything about the story of the Harlem Renaissance? I mean, everything isn't contained in one storyline, I suppose, is the narrative here.
Yeah, that's what makes the Renaissance great, is that it's also a period of time where writers are taking up a variety of issues, right? So you have someone like Schuyler, who's writing an early sci-fi, if you will, imagining what happens in the United States if somebody were to invent a machine that could turn Black people white. Would that solve the race problem in the United States? It has a beautiful cover too, such a neat cover of the early edition. And then you have Rudolf Fischer, who dies very young. He's a doctor in Harlem, but he's also a fiction writer. He writes The Conjure Man Dies, which is an early mystery novel, asking the question of what makes somebody Black. So there are a set of questions writers are thinking through, but they're coming at them through a variety of genres. And then Infants of Spring is kind of like a thinly veiled expose of the Harlem Renaissance writers.
Yeah, and, so, sort know, of critical. So, you know,
yes, and highly critical.
Revolutionaries do not like to be criticized by their own people, you know. So,
but it's satirical, it's funny. And if you know who's who, it's an even better read.
And then the exhibit also contains a children's book, doesn't it, by Langston Hughes and Anna Bontemps? That's quite nice, actually. So, these works from the early decades of the 20th century tell us things about our own time, as they did for people in the 1960s and the civil rights movement that was underway. And so I wonder, are the morals and lessons here from this exhibit to be contemplated and incorporated into our own attempts to solve our own national problems, do you think? I would guess possibly your students, as they were reading this material, might be able to give us ideas. Did you seem to in the labels?
I think we learn a lot from the Harlem Renaissance in terms of how do you think about these larger questions that continue to plague the United States, I think, kind of racial violence, racial animus, but also Black joy and the power of aesthetics to shift hearts and minds. I really feel like it's a period that's exciting because it's one of these early moments where a bunch of Black artists are able to really collectively chart a vision that's multifaceted and multi-formed, multimedia, that speaks to their experience in the United States. And I feel like, you know, we're always, I would say this as a scholar of African-American literature and culture, it's always exciting to me when writers are given the chance and take the opportunity to imagine the future and critique the present and the past in ways that shape a future, and that we're allowed to kind of sit and think with them after the fact is probably the best part of my job and the best part of teaching. And so, yeah, I think the students having the opportunity to write the labels are obviously writing from this moment backwards. And so any kind of insights that they have are a melding of what's there and kind of, I think, what they want to highlight based on their own experiences in the now.
Yeah. And our students are the people of the future in a way, you know, they're all younger than we are now, you know, so
I guess they are.
They are, yeah. So they've got one foot in the future. So, and something at stake there.
Yeah.
So Carolyn, do you have a favorite object in the,
Yeah, it is hard.
The images are wonderful, all of them. So,
yes, I think my favorite is probably James Weldon Johnson's God's Trombones, Seven Negro Sermons and Verse. And that's because it's an object that goes beyond this exhibition and this object of the book in particular, because it's a book of seven Negro sermons that were inspired by Johnson's childhood memories of sermons by these Black preachers. And Aaron Douglas was commissioned to illustrate each of the sermons that are included in the book. But what's interesting about Douglas's illustrations is they're not just pictorializing the action that's happening in the verses. They're made to enhance them. and accompany them as well. So you get this interplay that becomes really dynamic between the images and the texts. So it's sort of like more than the sum of the parts, which is
the
really
whole is more than the sum of the parts. You make that really clear in your essay. You write
beautifully
on it.
So the way that this book moves beyond the walls of the Vassar Library is that Aaron Douglas illustrated the book, but then he went back years later and he took these small black and white grayscale engravings that he did for the book and blew them up and painted them in bright colors on large canvases. And those works are now in the collections of famed art institutions like the Met and the Cleveland Museum of Art in Ohio. So he's continuing to think as a maker, as a creator, about this work long after the book was published in the 1920s. And I really like that.
Yeah, wonderful.
Eve, have we heard your favorite?
I don't have a favorite, but just in being forced to think about it, the book that I enjoy the most looking at and then also reading is The Skylar Black No More, just because I think it's such a interesting what if, and I love teaching it when I teach it because he takes such great leaps of thought and nothing as compelling, I think, Caroline, as your rationale. So you can I don't think I'm adding anything.
Well, no, I think, you know, the fact that the most interesting part about the Harlem Renaissance is this connection with the future and with modernism. And science fiction is a modernism par excellence, isn't it? It's where all our hopes are, basically. So
I also love the fact that that book comes out with a pulp press. So it's really interesting to me.
Ron, do you have a favorite?
You know, I learned so much from seeing all of these assembled together. It really was literally eye-opening. But if I had to pick one, if you're going to force me to pick one, I actually think, you know, being an archival person, I would pick that copy of The Weary Blues, which is autographed by Langston Hughes. And the story there is that actually isn't I think it's the fourth printing of the book. It's 1927. It's not the very first printing. It has that iconic dust jacket. But what really is interesting from Vassar's perspective is that copy is part of our Helen Wright collection. Helen Wright was an alum who in the early 20th century developed a collection of books that were autographed by various authors. And so she would send these books directly to the writers and ask them to autograph it or say something in the book for her and then mail it back to her. We have a large collection of these books. They're a wonderful record of American literature at that time period. So one of the figures that she wrote to was Langston Hughes. And at the time, he was at Lincoln University, which is in Pennsylvania. And he sends her an autograph inscription, and he notes the date and that he's at Lincoln University. So there's a wonderful real life story there between this important figure of the Harlem Renaissance and a Vassar graduate. And tells us something about her reading and reception of these works and how they connected. So I think I would pick that as my favorite.
Wow, great story. Often your books, knowing the provenance and how they were acquired, there's often a lot there, you know, to ponder. So, and then what do you have planned for the fall in terms of exhibition?
So for the fall, I think we also have what will be a wonderful exhibition. It's actually going to be a display of postcards of Elizabeth Bishop. I've been working with two outside scholars on this, two Bishop scholars, one in England, one in the US, and one of them focuses on her texts and another on the visual images. And although, as you know, there's been a lot of scholarship on Elizabeth Bishop, I dare say it's the most heavily used collection in our archives, there hasn't been much attention to the postcards because previously they were dismissed as unimportant. They're just a postcard. But actually now we're seeing that because of both the visual and the way they connect with other parts of her life, they're quite significant. And we have over 500 of them in our collection. We won't be able to display all 500, but these scholars are visiting and making a selection, and we'll put those on display. We also will do a catalog with scholarly essays. And we also think that this may travel This exhibition may travel. So I'm really excited about that. We'll have an event around it and something to look forward to as well.
Yeah, it sounds exciting.
It and seems I won't connect both Eve and Caroline as well because of visual and,
That sounds
American.
So cool. Yeah, that sounds awesome. I can't wait to go walk through.
Okay, so we'll have to talk to you about that in the falls. Okay, so well, thanks a million for being on the show today.
Thanks very much, Tom. It was a pleasure to be here and talk to you a little bit about this project, and I hope others enjoy hearing about it.
Well, so, thank you, Tom, so much for having us. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you for this, Tom. It was great to I don't think we've gotten to kind of sit and reflect together, so it's been really a great opportunity. I always enjoy working with you on these. It's so much fun.
Oh, great. Yo, I'm really glad to have you. So take care. Okay.
Good idea.
Okay.
So long, thank you. Okay. Thanks,
bye.
Tom. Thanks, Eve.
Thanks. Bye.